You're listening to Work Tape, episode 138.
Welcome to another edition of the Work Tape podcast. It is your boy Money Mitchell, Isaac Rubin Grover.
Hello, listeners.
And speaking of money, we talked last week a little bit about James Blake's comments regarding the state of streaming and music consumption as a whole. And for those who don't know or are living under a rock or are just maybe unfamiliar, James Blake, huge producer right now. I feel like he's even more of a producer than like a artist per se, although he is a great singer-songwriter as well in the R&B space. I feel like he's gotten a lot of his cred recently for producing for hip hop artists like Travis Scott and Frank Ocean and The Works. His production's really good, that's why.
But he does seem to be taking more of a higher stance now.
Mm-hmm. But he came around and dropped some comments on X, what was known as Twitter, a couple weeks ago or within the last week or so, basically calling out the streaming services, saying that if high quality music is to be expected, then someone is going to have to pay for it, implying that the streaming platforms have maybe lessened the value of music, especially amongst like the general public. He brought up some really great and, you know, kind of scary stats in regards to, you know, how there's really only a top portion of artists on Spotify and these various streaming services that can actually truly make their money from the streaming services. And most of these, as we've mentioned, are like the big players who already have like massive followings.
Based on what you and I have read, it was like 19% that had more than 1,000.
Yeah.
Which is not that big.
Right. Just a very small kind of section of the music making population. And so personally, I think that he decided to spit the facts as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, he also mentioned as well that he felt like he was one of the last musicians to come in and get set up with music before streaming took precedence. And then you had all of these labels wanting bigger cuts. You had the streaming really taking over as the main way of consumption and, you know, completely went away from physical sales. And he felt like kind of one of the last of that particular breed of artist, which I think we had talked about on the last episode too, how some of the artists like your Kendricks or your Bruno Mars or whatever were like the last of that like round, like the 2010s, 2013, you're in that camp if you're like within that period of time, because that was when, you know, iTunes was still around and people were still buying, you know, a lot of physical stuff. But it's interesting as well, because I think we had also said at one point that physical media may make a comeback for like this very reason, in the respect that it allows the fans to directly like support their favorite artists. It also is a more like personal thing for the fans as well to have, you know, vinyls and whatnot.
I think it's definitely a bygone era, or what feels like a bygone era, with everything becoming kind of dissipating from physicality. And I think it would be a warm welcome to have that back. I honestly don't miss the clutter of physical, but I do miss that tactility. And I miss the, I think we treated things differently. Like we had a different mentality when things were physical. It's almost like the physical doesn't really make things, but it almost, I don't know. You almost act differently when it's physical. When something is intangible like that, you know, I remember, you know, early aughts, the MP3 days. I mean, those were really cool. And I remember the whole like 5,000 songs or 1,000 songs in your pocket. I mean, I don't regret the iPod era. But what I do dislike is that things can't just like stop. They have to continue progressing. And I think what happens is as you progress, you start to regress a bit.
Right.
it's kind of like we got to the iPod, like, oh, it's great, you know? And then like we kept going and it was like, whoa, 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 slow down. Like, this is really good, you know? Like, we don't have to go further. And like, yes, we have to go further. And I mean, it's happening with a lot of different things in the industries, including automobiles. Like, you know, we had like this high point of cars and now they're getting worse. Now all cars look like gigantic tablets. I think it sucks. So I have noticed this has happened for music, you know, long before.
Yeah. Long story short, though, so James Blake came out and, you know, basically disrupted a lot of things with these X statements, basically. Thus, a lot of people said, okay, well, you're going to come out and make mention of all these things. You know, what are you going to try to do to help the situation? And he did exactly that. He is pairing up with this company, which seems like a startup company called Vault. And essentially what they're able to do is he is able to put out unreleased music directly from his hard drive or his vault. And the service is offering musicians to do the same. And basically, in order to listen to the material, you have to pay, I believe, a subscription price, or you have to pay a direct price of like $5 or $10 or something.
Five.
And you get the music unlocked. And then that $5 or $10 is going to go directly to James and is not going to go anywhere else. And then what I also thought was cool about this, other than, of course, the direct to consumer model of, you know, music being able to be unlocked and providing fans, you know, an opportunity to listen to some unreleased music or to get, like, you know, early access kind of in a way before the rest of the general public does. The other thing that's cool that they had as part of this app was the ability to have almost kind of a YouTube or like Instagram type feature where you're able to have a discussion on the app around the music. And I thought that was cool, that kind of like social engagement aspect of, say, James Blake or, you know, whatever artist puts out this unreleased song from their vault, then a bunch of their fans are able to kind of create a conversation. And then it gives, of course, fans more of like a social connection with the music. But then it also gives the artist, you know, pretty much direct feedback as well, you know, in terms of what's hitting, what's not, you know. So it's really cool in that aspect. But of course, the big draw is the direct-to-consumer model. And I really do believe that between like this and even.biz and a couple of other platforms that are out there, I'm really going to probably say at this point that I think direct-to-consumer is going to be a big thing, because we have now seen that the streaming services are lowballing the artists majorly in pretty much every regard. And I think that the direct-to-consumer thing is really going to come out and kind of level the playing field a bit more, especially for independent artists. I think that it's going to be more direct-to-consumer for independent artists, more so than the major players. Because as I said before, with the major players, they're not going to be nearly as affected by a lot of these streaming things. Although there actually is supposedly a piece of legislation that may be passed where it would require Spotify and I believe different streaming services to pay a cent, a whole cent per stream, which may actually change things, because you have, you know, of course, songs that have hundreds of thousands or millions or even billions of streams. And if now the pay rate gets mandated to where everybody has to be paid a cent per stream, regardless of how big they are, and regardless of what the other contracts are in place, that could actually change something, I think, for the better.
I agree. I can't believe it's got to be a cent, though.
Well, because okay, at this point, currently, they're getting, like, what, fractions of a penny? You know, basically, they're not even getting a whole penny. They're getting fractions of a penny right now.
That's what I'm saying, though. I'm just saying the idea of 1,000 giving you $10, I think, you know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. I'd be grateful for that. I just think it's funny that we were doing a fraction of a cent, you know, and now it's like, okay, let's push it to a cent. That's what I just find funny.
Yeah, to a whole cent. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I feel you there. I mean, in a perfect world, you know, in a perfect world, it would be like $1 per stream.
That's what I'm saying.
but that's not going to happen because there's no way that Spotify or the labels would be willing to probably do that.
No, of course not. Right. That's a perfect world.
And if that did happen, then the cost of all these streaming services would be like $50 to get all this. Instead of $10, you'd be spending like $50. It would basically be like Tidal in a way, because that was the whole thing with Tidal.
That's what I'm saying, though. I remember I was saying the whole like progression to the point of regression. I'm not necessarily against all these streaming platforms. I'm just saying we traded what we had 20 years ago for this, is my point.
Right. And here's the thing. I thought that iTunes actually worked really well, to be honest. I thought that the whole thing with iTunes worked really, really well in the respect that it was a digital platform. They made it pretty easy for you to have a lot of this digital music, especially with the iPod, iTunes, you know, ecosystem. And, you know, the labels and the artists were happy because even when the pricing of that went up to $1.29 for songs, they still got a lot of kickback, you know, especially if you had a song that was, you know, bought a lot.
That's literally what I'm talking about. I miss that hybrid model. So.
Right, but the bell can't be unrung at this point in regards to...
It can't be unrung, but legislation can be passed and we can progress back that regress a bit, you know?
Yeah. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this thing goes with James Blake and Vault, especially in conjunction, like I was saying, with some of the other like direct-to-consumer models that are coming out, like even.biz and... various others, I think, as well. But those are the major ones that I can just name off the top of my head, because it really may change things, especially for independent artists. Because if these direct-to-consumer models like Vault or even.biz, you know, continue to get traction and continue to be proven as like financially, you know, beneficial for the independent artist, there may be a lot of people who will say, you know what, I'm not going to sign to a major label at all, even if I'm getting offers, because I can just directly sell it through these platforms and pocket pretty much all of the money. So I think there's going to be a big push for it.
That's the equalizer I think that this industry has needed for a long time.
Which is so interesting, because if you think about it, the whole direct-to-consumer thing is kind of old school as well. But I guess with the technology, it's made it even easier to go direct-to-consumer, because even back in the days of the original days of, you know, vinyl and singles and LPs and CDs, even that wasn't exactly direct-to-consumer.
Mm-mm.
A lot of times the label or whatever released the album, and, you know, it was in a marketplace, sure, you know, a record store, right? But with the technology now, you know, they can just directly sell to the fan base as opposed to just selling to the general public. You know what I'm getting at?
It's kind of Bandcampy.
Yeah. Well, Bandcamp kind of went under, right? So
yeah.
So someone has to pick up the torch and continue to do it. But
because someone, you know, they saw what Bandcamp did, they were like, oh, this is a good idea, you know, let's also make these little tweaks and improvements, right? And so go figure, it goes under and they're like, we're not letting it go down that easily. And then someone's going to rise up, hopefully, like you just said, take the torch and do something with it. That's what I think.
Yeah,
it's better for all of us too, you know, considering that 80% of us, more than 80% of us,
yeah,
you know, we make pennies on the dollar. It's just, I don't know. It's fine. I'm just saying it's not fine, you know?
Right. But I'm just curious to see how this is all going to go down, especially with, you know, James Blake endorsing this one. Not to say that he's one of the all-time biggest, you know, in the industry, but he's pretty big. And so having that co-sign may really continue to
progress things along. Speaking of bells,
that was a good one.
Drake Bell has come out with a new song, and it's pretty good. It's very McCartney-esque. That's just, I mean,
that's what he doubled down on since 2004. I mean, earlier than 2004, actually.
Yeah. He's been doing the McCartney sound for
since he was a kid.
Yeah, for a long time now. And honestly, you know, good on him for it, because if you're gonna base your sound amongst a particular artist, McCartney is not the worst choice, especially the solo McCartney.
That might be better than a Noel the Gallagher's or something like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But I mean, just like in the inflection, the chord progressions, as you were kind of stating even before we started recording, it very much sounds like a McCartney song from like the solo era. So not even the Wings McCartney, more like just like his solo stuff, which I think is cool. I think, like, you know, the fact that he's out here doing that is really dope. The big thing to take away, more than the song even, I think, is the video, just because it chronicles
the Nickelodeon scandal.
Yeah, as well as like his car accident, and I think like his various arrests and whatnot. So I think that was overall a pretty like smart move to do that with the song, especially since that interview just came out as well, which, as we were saying before the podcast even started, really, since that interview came out, the whole perception on Drake Bell has changed dramatically, because he was being lumped in with like Michael Jackson and R. Kelly
and Harvey Weinstein, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of like disgraced, you know, media personalities. And then some more information came out on the story. I guess the person who, you know, brought the charges against him lied, you know, about how old they were, and some more details of the story came out that proved that he wasn't maybe as guilty as we maybe were led on to believe.
This is a bit of a rare case, because most times when someone gets damned like that, they stay damned. They stay kind of in that condemned corner and they don't come back. So I think Drake is coming around. Not only has it happened, it's happened rather quickly.
Right. Just off of one interview, basically. For this documentary.
Yeah. I mean, Quiet on the Set was like, this is like another breakthrough for Drake. I don't know if he's doing the Campana thing again, but I don't know if he's going to stay in about that either.
I think based on the single that we just heard, I think he's not going to do that anymore.
So he's going back to the Bell.
Huh?
Back to the Bell, right? No more Mexico? Well,
yeah, because as you noticed on the single, he didn't release this McCartney single as Drake Campagna, or whatever it is.
I think
he
released it
as Drake Bell, which, I mean, I guess what he could do theoretically is, for his McCartney stuff, he could release it under his actual name. And then if he wanted to release Latin music at the same time, he could go under Campagna if he wanted.
They do love him down there. I mean, why kill it?
Right. Because that's kind of unfortunately what ended up happening with him post Drake and Josh, was that, you know, once that series ended, he tried to get a situation going like a Miley Cyrus situation, in terms of pivoting a TV show, a beloved TV show, into a longstanding music career. And it just never happened for him.
You know, someone's such a large Paul McCartney influence going to Mexico. Must have been like a ban on the run.
Oh my God. Yeah, I had a feeling there was going to be some sort of joke about that whole thing. But it was just really interesting that it's kind of odd that he wasn't able to get that music thing going as much, because he is a talented guy. And I think that even in the mid-2000s, his sound actually kind of fit in, because wasn't that around the same time that Panic at the Disco put out Pretty Odd, which was like the big kind of Baroque pop homage record?
Yes, you know, you're right. You're right, because Drake Bell, actually, you're right. There was a big thing of people doing the Paul McCartney Beatles sound, because Paul Doucet from, I think, Matchbox 20, he did some stuff with, remember Shredder Man? When the guy from Ned's Declassified, I forgot his name.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
That was from 2007. That was a total Beatles rip, which I loved. I loved Better Days. That's one of my favorite tracks from the aughts. And then Pretty Odd with Panic at the Disco. That was 2008. So the mid-late aughts was like that whole Paul McCartney revival sound. Even though they're kind of, there is a little bit of that sound in the early aughts as well as the late 90s. Actually, the whole 90s. Oasis brought back like that whole Beatles revival sound. So I'm going to give that to Oasis.
Oh, sure. But I feel like even Oasis brand of Britpop was different.
It's different. You're right. It is different.
I think with Oasis, it seemed a little more, there were some songs especially that seemed a little more psychedelic, like Champagne Supernova or whatnot. And I felt like Oasis had a heavier version of the sound. Like, that was the whole thing with Oasis, was like the guitars were the main focus.
Yes. Can I be honest? I do trash on Oasis quite a bit verbally, but I actually love Wonderwall. I actually like a lot of their songs.
As do I.
Yeah, and you do too. Like, I actually do like Oasis, okay? Just going to say that.
I like Oasis also.
And yeah, I think you have not been hating on them as much as I have, though. So I just wanted to kind of say that, because I think everyone knows that you like them. But I just wanted to say that Oasis, it's not that I don't like Oasis. I'm just not big on bands that, like, they kind of sounded a little too Beatles-y for me at points. But I have come to really appreciate their songwriting. And any band or artist who takes from Oasis, and I don't think Drake took that much from them as he took from Paul. But
took a lot more from Paul. Yeah.
But a lot of aughts bands did take from Oasis. And I don't really condemn that. The Posies was one of them.
Oh sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but they're a great band, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I mean, if, you know, there was a one night reunion with Oasis, I would need to get tickets, you know, because that's just one of those things. But
Drake. I also want to say that I know, like, Drake got trashed. He got pulled through. Dude, he got trashed for quite a bit. But
Drake Bell?
Yes, he did. And you're going back to that era, that sound. I think he released his first album 2004, 2005. It might have been 2005, right after Drake and Josh debuted.
Drake and Josh, yeah.
But you know, I like that album. I love Don't Preach. You know, I Found a Way was obviously on that record.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that was a time when that whole Beatles-y sound was kind of, again, Oasis was part of that, but it furthered in the aughts. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't huge on throwbacky sounds, but the way that all those groups and artists did it, I liked. And I do remember Drake's happy-go-lucky, uppity, poppy, baroque pop sound. You know, I really liked that. And Drake was a big, was a big influence for me. And I just want to say, like, I like the dude. You know, I thought he was really cool. I know, like, he played like a little bit of the arrogant guy, and I kind of preferred Josh's personality on the show. But I always did like Drake's character. I thought that they had a great dynamic. You know, I hope things are well for them. And I'm sorry that he had to go through all that he did, but I'm actually really proud of him. You know, he's been doing a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of I Know, that's a Drake Bell song that's also pretty good.
That one's good.
Once again, that kind of very much you listen to it and you figure, wow, this is, you know, you're really wearing the McCartney influence on your sleeve pretty hard here.
I think I'd give him a pass for some reason.
Well, I think it's just because, like, I think it comes from a genuine place. And I think that, like, lyrically, he does some things different. And it's not just like, oh, I'm doing this as a temporary gimmick to kind of cash in on something.
Yeah.
Like, I actually love this music in the same way that I felt that, like, Pretty Odd was a good album too. And it made a lot of sense because I could tell that Brendan Urie and company were influenced heavily by the Beatles, ELO, you know, some of those bands. And I think, honestly, it's a sound that works for Brendan Urie too.
So, Mitch, about Drake, Drake also did the post-grunge very well.
Mm.
I mean, I know his hair fit, you know, in that whole sound, because I Found a Way, Don't Preach, definitely took from that whole Foo Fighters, Nirvana sound, you know, because the natural progression. The Beatles' comeuppance was more of a throwback sound, whereas the post-grunge was more of a continuation of the modern rock sound. And so he actually did that pretty well. Of course, a lot of those guys sounded really corny because that's just the time and the era. But we all like that corniness, just like 80s corniness. We all come to fall in love with that sound. And I do remember that Hollywood thing during the running over Oprah days, which is hilarious. I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, it's a little dated and there are some things about it. They're like, okay, it's a bit corny, but it's kind of like a charming corny. And that's what Drake and Josh was about. And so I think that, you know, they did a good job with that.
Right. I think Drake was able to sell the corniness better than a lot of other people because he had the TV show, which also had a lot of corniness. So when he kind of went more corny with his music, people bought it a lot more.
He's a pretty good corny, I'm going to say.
Yeah. The only thing I didn't really like from him in terms of music was I thought his Latin stuff was okay. I didn't think it was terrible.
Sure.
But it was just okay, especially in comparison to other reggaeton artists that he was trying to kind of emulate.
You're correct.
The only other one that I think of that wasn't as good, he did try to do this like 50s throwback record.
He did the rockabilly thing. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, he did like the, I think the album was like Ready, Steady, Go or something. And it was like a throwback to like Brian Seltzer and like the Stray Cats. And like that type of sound.
I wasn't a fan. I actually, you know, it's funny. I think my brain disassociated from that and just threw it out. I think.
No, I didn't like it either. That's the only thing that I can think of musically that he did where I was kind of like, that was a major miss.
It was.
I mean, you know, he probably loves, you know, Brian Seltzer and all that too, but just not the right call.
No, the Beatles, Paul, and the post-grunge, he did well with that. And some of the Latin stuff. I think the Latin stuff was the second to worst.
No, the Latin stuff wasn't terrible. It just wasn't as polished or well-produced.
No. As and like, the rockabilly is definitely at the bottom. I agree with you.
Yeah, Drake Bell is no Bad Bunny in that respect.
No, he shouldn't be, though.
No, he really shouldn't be. No, absolutely. I agree with that. But it'll be interesting to hear kind of what Drake does. If this is like the first of many new songs, it would be interesting to see what this new album or if there's a new album, what it might sound like, especially in the wake of all of this kind of positive momentum in a way from a, you know, tragic situation. He has a lot of goodwill right now in the public. So.
He got a surprising comeback. I'm going to hand it to them and quiet on the set people and to all those survivors and Jeanette McCurdy, you know, just all these people.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where it's kind of like, you know, your childhood gets ruined a little bit, though, because especially if you're in a certain, you know, age demographic, you remember growing up with a lot of these shows.
You and me with all that and the Amanda Show.
Yeah, you're not going to look at a lot of it the same way. So.
No,
but it does create an interesting conversation also for the next episode, which is how, you know, treatment of musicians can change, but also just different tragedies turn triumph, especially from, you know, as kids, because, of course, I mentioned Michael Jackson, but then there's also plenty of other artists, musicians who had really tragic upbringings as kids. With a variety of different situations who are able to turn it around and become some of the biggest artists in the world. And I think that would be an interesting conversation for the next episode. So this has been the Work Tape Podcast. Money Mitchell, Isaac Rubin Grover. Stay hydrated, stay safe out there, and be good to one another. Peace.
Peace out, you guys.